So this morning, this is part two, we're going to discuss this paradigm that we ended with last time, this paradigm or typology of karma, jnana, and bhakti as a series of categories for understanding religions and ideologies. As you recall, part of the usefulness of this is it's indifferent to the traditional boundaries of Hinduism, Buddhism, or whatever. These categories are used by Srila Prabhupada to understand the Vedic tradition and to present Krishna consciousness in opposition to these other forms of spiritual life, karma and jnana. And we'll also discover that they can be used also in any religious tradition. My purpose in presenting this, in some ways, is everywhere to defeat Mayavad philosophy. I feel that Prabhupada's pranam mantra said that he was specifically come to defeat nirvishesha and shunyavada, two kinds of Mayavad philosophy, and establish Krishna consciousness. And so, quite frankly, that's what I'm about. Later on, you'll get Shanika will hand you out a paper that I gave at an interreligious dialogue conference, a conference of scholars. And I think it's pretty clear. In fact, I say, in fact, that this is what's going on. What we want to do is encourage bhakti wherever it is, and that means to discourage jnana and karma, or at least put them in their right place. So, I should just tell you a little. You know, I came to Krishna consciousness movement with some acquaintance with various religions in the world. I'd been for 3 years studying in a graduate school, different religions, and was already pretty much of a committed Mayavadi when I came to Krishna consciousness. And in fact, in my own personal spiritual development, I had started out as a philosophy student and just a general materialist, and at the end had gotten interested in the philosophy of originally Austrian philosophy, but it became very big at Cambridge, named Ludwig Wittgenstein. Heard of him before? Wittgenstein. Yeah, from Vienna originally, but became very, very big and was one of the founders of the philosophy of logical positivism, which ended up to have something of a mystical element to it, of which he could not speak. The famous ending of his book, Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen. And whatever he was silent about, that was the more interesting thing. He was just, there were... anyway, from Wittgenstein, I got interested in Buddhism, because actually they were very close. And later on, just recently, in fact, I discovered someone has written a book comparing Wittgenstein with Majjhimika Buddhism. But we always thought that, at least some students, we thought that Wittgenstein was actually close to Buddhism, even though he was, the empiricists were very, very much interested in him. Buddhism is the closest you can get, the most naturalistic form of transcendentalism, you might say. So then I was involved in, became interested in Buddhism, and from there, somehow or other, became interested in Shankaracharya. And when I met devotees, I was thinking of writing a doctoral dissertation on Shankaracharya and Hegel or something like that. And it was really in Krishna consciousness that I became convinced that Shankaracharya was wrong, and that Krishna consciousness was right. And actually, even from reading Shankaracharya, I had become convinced that actually you should worship God. And when I went to the temple and devotees were attacking Shankaracharya, I finally became very bold and said that I didn't really think that Shankaracharya was a Mayavadi. And I was expected to get chastised. But then the devotee says, oh, actually, you're right. I was really surprised. So this kind of thing that personally I went through, from being a logical empiricist or a strict empiricist to Buddhism, to Shankaracharya, to Krishna consciousness, turns out to be a kind of standard progression of spiritual life. And in fact, I found in Prabhupada's work a discussion of all these different phases of Krishna consciousness. And so I was acquainted when I began to read Prabhupada's books with things in various religious traditions and philosophies. And naturally, you take what you think you know and try to understand it or reinterpret everything in terms of Krishna consciousness. And it was one of my great discoveries to discover that where Prabhupada talks about karma and jnana and bhakti and analyzes them and criticizes them in their different ways, that this was an extremely powerful set of tools or categories for understanding human spiritual life. It not only explained myself or what I had gone through, but a great deal of human history. And so I tried to develop this. I started looking at these three ideas. What we mean by karma. Prabhupada, of course, when he talks about karma kanda, there's actually something very specifically meant in the Vedas, which is the culture of sacrificial performances for elevation to the higher planets. And this developed in earlier times into a school. One of the six philosophies was called Karma Mimamsa. Jaimini was the philosopher who this is attributed to. And in this Karma Mimamsa school, that's the one where they say, you know, ritualistic performances is everything. The goal is elevation to the higher planets. And there's nothing more than this. This is the meaning of the Vedas. So they take this ritualistic portion of the Vedas, the Karma Kanda portion of the Vedas, and make it into everything. And this is what the Karma Mimamsa school does. So that's a bit, but then there's a wider idea of what karma means, which is basically just what people call this worldliness, just trying to get the things of this world. Huh? I think in one paper I wrote about here, karma denotes those rationally organized activities aimed at acquiring the good things of life for ourselves and those we identify with ourselves. Thus we labor to gain secure and continuous possession and enjoyment of health and vitality, of land and goods and money, of grace, charm and beauty, of love, honor and repute, and the like. Just all the things of this world. Even though we may be going for it after the end of this life, it's still this worldly because it's based on sense gratification. There's just The goal of karma is the Svargaloka, the heavenly planets. That destination is very clear. And heavenly planets is just higher forms of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There are apsaras, there's soma ras, and gandharvas. So, so we have to see that it's not that elevated from the ultimate point of view. So that's the Karmakanda section of the Vedas. But it also, the way Prabhupada describes it, the way he uses the word karmi, is for anybody who's involved in the fruits of their work, not necessarily engaged in elevation to the higher planets and so on. Then, of course, we come to this this next idea of jnana. Let me backtrack a bit before we go on to jnana. Now, if you look at this particular form of culture of Vedic sacrifice, or also a little different is puja, the worship of the devatas, that they're involved in sacrifice, but also there's another development. There's another development where there's puja to devatas for elevation also to the higher planets. But then you'll see also, if you look at other religions, everywhere people are going to some kind of divine entities for their material welfare. And in many cases, you see the same system, whereas in the Vedic system, people go to the devatas instead of to the Supreme Lord, who is too awesome, too heavy, and his demands are unconditional for surrender. So you want to deal with somebody who's a little lower on the scale, and maybe you can bribe a little more. Therefore, people they deal with lesser entities. In Roman Catholic Church, they're all the saints who perform the same intermediary functions as devatas for granting your desires and taking care of your needs. So everywhere you'll see this trafficking with lesser beings for achieving things. You also find that many people, although they seem to be worshiping, they say they're worshiping God, you actually find out that their concept of God is very primitive, and mostly they want from God heaven. And by heaven they mean a place of extended, if somewhat mild, sense gratification. That's what they mean. It's a place you go for your reward. It's like one long Sunday, a little boring for the kids, but if you're maybe 70 years old, it's nice. You know? And it's just a place of extended, mild sense gratification. This is what they think. You know, this is what usually those of us brought up in the West, when people talk about heaven, that's usually what they mean. Your reward, in the future. And this is what people are worshiping for this kind of thing. So you see this level, this Karmakanda level. Of course, what you see in the Vedic tradition and Krishna consciousness is this very clear notion that heaven is one place, Svargaloka, and the kingdom of God is another place altogether. Whereas if you look, say, at a Christian tradition, its whole thing is pretty fuzzy, and it's only by discovering what different worshippers think that you see that people really have different destinations in mind. You get somebody who's fairly renounced and very, very devout, they might see heaven. You know, in fact, it is in the higher literature of Christianity. It's the beatific vision. It's the continuous vision of God or something like that. That's what it's about. Not about long Sunday afternoons or whatever. So these are sometimes not so clearly separated, but in Krishna consciousness there. So there's this level, this karma level. and then the level what we see of jnana. So of course here, in when we come to the jnana level, which specifically refers within Vedic tradition to the Advaita Vedanta philosophy of Shankaracharya. That takes the jnana to the extreme. Just like there's a Karma Kanda section of the Vedas, and the Karma Mimamsa takes it to an extreme. And we'll discuss a little later exactly what they do. Also the parts of the Upanishads that talk about gaining knowledge and becoming Brahman, that is taken to the extreme by the Advaita Vedanta of Shankaracharya, which is called Purva Mimamsa also. That Advaita Vedanta is called, there's another name, is Karma Mimamsa, and then Purva, later Mimamsa. That's another school. But then you see, and of course it's famous, this Advaita Vedanta is famous for this negative, neti-neti, na-itti-na-itti, that you Brahman is understood by the process of negation. It is not this, it is not that, it is not this, it is not that, which appears in the Upanishads. But then you discover, if you know anything about Western philosophy and theology, this is all over the place in the West. In fact, it has a name. The name is, in Latin, via negativa. The negative way. The standard name. It's also called apophatic theology. This is a Greek, apophysis is a Greek word for negation. It's a standard procedure in theology that the divine or God is defined by negation. And usually this is called mysticism or mystical theology. And you see it very early. First of all, you see it among the Greeks. And boy, does it look like Mayavad philosophy. It really is there. It shows up. And there's the best place it shows up, called the group of philosophers called Eleatics. The big criticism of the Homeric gods, Xenophanes, not Protagoras, but it'll come back. And his student was Zeno. You know Zeno's famous paradoxes, you know, that motion is impossible? That was supposed to show that the material world didn't exist. The world looks real, but if you analyze it closely, you see this, it's all self-contradictions. Something that's self-contradictory cannot possibly exist. So there we see, actually, it's not there. That's what those Zeno's paradoxes were originally meant to show. And then in Plato, you get this negative theology. And it becomes even more pronounced in what's called Neoplatonic thought, especially Plotinus, who became a big influence during the whole Middle Ages. In Plotinus's work, you see he was, dated around the 5th century. Although he wrote under an earlier name. But he was a big authority, and in his work you see things like he's describing God as beyond cause, beyond effect, beyond good, beyond bad, beyond this, beyond that, and then he says beyond, beyond. So everything is negated. Like that. So this strand is very much there in Christian thought, integrated within Christian thought. Although it really comes more from the Greeks, from Parmenides and Xenophanes and so on. So here you see these things crop up in different places. So I was familiar with these various manifestations. And I began to look at this karma, jnana, and bhakti notion that Prabhupada gave. And then I began to realize there was a very interesting progressive relationship among these three areas. How did you go from karma, if you were to go, if this was a kind of journey of the soul, shall we say, from karma to jnana to bhakti, in many cases it's described like that. How does it work? Huh? And when I looked at it, I saw a pattern. Now at this point, I guess we're going to get involved with what we have to call philosophical speculation. Philosophical speculation differs from mental speculation in that the goal of philosophical speculation is Krishna. So, because this particular pattern, which seems to be there and seems to be illustrative of things, is not mentioned anywhere in Srila Prabhupada's books explicitly. It's something I've noticed. So you say you have these three things. I have to wait for this part to dry. You have karma, and you have jnana, then you have bhakti. So karma is this worldly, right? It's involved with the things of this world. It means looking for what's here and wanting it very badly. Now, when does a person go from karma to jnana? Prabhupada's really clear about that. When he becomes disgusted. When he becomes disappointed. When he can't take it anymore. Dharma, artha, kama, and when he can't enjoy anymore, then moksha. So this is a revolt. This is a definite an opposition of the spirit. It's a complete turning away or a negation of the world. So while karma celebrates and enjoys this world as the highest thing, whether it's here or the heavenly planets, it's still this material world as the best thing, jnana throws the whole thing out. So when I begin to notice here, it's antithetical. It's in opposition. There's a definite opposition to this. So what karma says, for example, karma exalts in action. In fact, that's what karma means, is action. Worldly action. Fruit of action, Prabhupada says. And so jnana says, all our actions lead to nothing but misery, so therefore, inaction, right? The antithesis of this, of action, negation of action. This is taught by Shankaracharya. When karma looks around and it is absorbed with names, name and form in the material world, name, form, qualities, activities, relationships, all these things. So jnana tries to imagine or understand the spirit as the opposite of these things. So again, you know, no name, no form, so on. This is a negative sign logic. No name, no form, just the opposite, right? So this is interesting. And then I notice what happens when you come to the level of bhakti.
You go beyond jnana to bhakti. But what does Prabhupada say about bhakti? There is action, but it's karmaless action. It's so it's simultaneously action and inaction. And isn't there a verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Krishna says, who can see action and inaction and action is wise. Huh? What bhakti yoga presents is it says, this inaction is wrong, and this action is wrong. Doesn't it? So what you have in bhakti yoga is acting without acting. From a material point of view, what you have in bhakti yoga is completely contradictory. It's the synthesis of action and inaction. So when I noticed that, I thought, wow, there it is, you know. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, the old dialectic, you know, that was supposedly there in G.W.F. Hegel. So I had to stop at this one and think, wait a minute, could Hegel be right about anything? How is that possible? but there it is. The pattern is unmistakable, huh? You have a spiritual progression, and that's, of course, what Hegel thought he was describing, the progress of the spirit. You know, for Hegel, the history of the world is the evolution of the spirit coming to full self-consciousness for the struggles and tensions and wars of history, you know, which is a great science fiction. Probably the best there is, but not much truth. But still, he was probably on to something true, you know, so everybody gets a little bit of the truth. So this is what you got. You got karma, jnana, and then bhakti. You got this synthesis, huh? Acting without acting. In other words, actions that are done for the sake of Krishna, they produce no karma, and yet it's still not in action. And you start to sound pretty mystical at this point when Prabhupada said, for example, the chanting of Hare Krishna is silence. There are people who like Zen koans and stuff like that. Huh? The chanting of Hare Krishna is silence. There's no material sound. Yet there's the chanting of Hare Krishna. We're not just... Because in the stage of karma, you babble all kinds of nonsense. Whether it's about the higher planets or about the Hollywood stars, whatever your cultural representation is, you know, you talk nonsense, name and form in the material world. In jnana, you shut up. God is realized in silence. Maunam. In jnana, you shut up. You're just quiet. In bhakti, there's something else. There's transcendental name, form, sound, speech, and so on. Now let's look at this idea here. You have material name and form. Then you have the negation of these things. And then in bhakti, you have, you know, spiritual name, form, etc. Again, a kind of a synthesis. Krishna has no material name, but he has a name that's Krishna. It's not a material sound. Now, what it seems to you I'm doing is taking something that's kind of obvious and making it harder to understand by this thesis antithesis synthesis bit. Where it pays off is when you start to use this to analyze history. And because what you show with this model is that, because this is not difficult for us, because Prabhupada explains it so easy and so clearly, you know. But to a person who's on these platforms, what we are talking about is unintelligible. Now, when you get to the stage of this jnana stage, the stage of negation, here you have the position of the Mayavadis who say, this is it, this is the highest realization. But Prabhupada has got a very telling criticism of this. Of this process of negation. He says they're trying to understand what is absolute by negation. But since the negations are just the opposites of the relative names and forms, they themselves are also relative. So they depend upon and are tied to what they negate. So you really don't have a view of the absolute in its own right. All you have is a negative material view. You're still in the world of relativity. The idea of no name depends upon the concept of name for it to have meaning. So you're still tied in to the material world. Karma and jnana shares a thing in common. They both of them have a view of this has a view that the material world is to be enjoyed. This has a view that the material world is to be rejected. When they get this all the way out, they want to say the material world doesn't exist at all.
That's how the rejection goes as far as it can. That's really what Shankaracharya says. It's not there. You have a problem because what is it you're talking about that's not there to begin with, and what's all this trouble for liberation? But what he really wants to say is it's not there. That's the most thoroughgoing sort of negative theology. Bhakti says the material world is neither to be enjoyed nor to be renounced. You see, if I'm saying it's to be renounced, it means I think that is by its own essential nature enjoyable. So I accept that evaluation. Yes, this is the world of enjoyment, and therefore I'm rejecting it. Neither of these, from our point of view, see the world in relationship to Krishna. You see, they both have that in common. In both of them, there is no relationship to Krishna. They both performed an act of alienation from Krishna. On the karma platform, this world is to be enjoyed, which is an act of theft, of expropriation. In jnana, now I reject that enjoyment. But still, the act of theft is there because I still don't see, I don't give it back to Krishna. I don't utilize it in Krishna's service. I just try to hide the stolen goods, so to speak, but I don't return them to the owner. So they have these things in common. So anyway, I noticed this progression. And I was a little afraid of being a little speculative, especially with this Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis business. But yet there it was. And especially when Prabhupada criticizes this jnana phrase as being incomplete. He says it is incomplete negation. So the completion is there in bhakti. In English, the philosophers use the word when you go from this to this, sublation. I think that Hegel used a simpler word, aufheben, you know, just lift it. But sublation means that you take something that's here, action or inaction, and it appears again on the higher platform, but in a transformed way. So bhakti actually has this characteristic of being contradictory. Now, you say like this. What happens is, did I turn this on? Is it on? Okay, there we go. What happens is, if you say something like spiritual name, a Mayavadi will reject it. On this grounds, he says it's a contradiction. Or take the word form, name or form. Spiritual form. We're saying that Krishna has spiritual form. But their assumption, their presupposition is all form is material form. Hmm? Because, you know, this is where it's tied in with karma, because they're both of them rooted in the material world. This is called avishuddha buddhaya, contaminated intelligence. Because their intelligence is contaminated, all their idea of form derives from the material world. And so they think all form is material form. Almost by definition, form means material form. So if you say that's what form means by definition, when you say the negation is, you know, no form, but if you say, well, no, there's spiritual form, I said, that doesn't make any sense. Because they've got it rooted in their mind that form means material form. They're taking the basis of their experience in the material world and making it the standard, normative for everything. All form is material form. And we have to say, who says so? Where is it written? That is your experience. That is your contaminated intelligence. That all action, they say, is material action. It all leads to pain and suffering. Well, that's their experience in this world. And in fact, they're so appalled by action, they can only think of inaction as any source of relief. You tell them about spiritual activity, they say, oh, no, I don't want any of that. And Prabhupada gives the example of a guy that comes to the temple, and he has some sweet rice, and there's been, for the first time he comes, the Sunday feast, there's been an error in the kitchen and sand has been put into the sweet rice. And he tastes the sweet rice with the sand in it, and he's polite, he doesn't say anything. And the next time he comes to the temple, again you offer him sweet rice, he says, oh no, I've had that. So he considers from then on, sweet rice means it has got sand in it. And so he rejects it. In the same way, the Mayavadis, the Gyanis, they reject action because of their experience in the world. So that's why these two are very closely tied together. They have some common ground, which is only transcended in bhakti. So this is basically the paradigm as Prabhupada gives it, karma, jnana, bhakti. And it has this very interesting progressive kind of structure. This dialectic. It's all, you know, there must, people have picked up on it. Hegel says it, and a famous statement in Taoism is reversal is the movement of the Tao, or return is the movement of the Tao, you know. And this is, you have this kind of return movement in here. I haven't had the chance to see what to make of that entirely. You could explore it further, but I haven't. Now, if you start to apply this, the first time I used this was when I was had to give a paper in front of a group, a conference for the study of religion in South India. And they were having a conference on deity worship. They wanted to understand deity worship. So they asked me to come and speak, you know, from my point of view, what it was, because I was somebody who had taken up the practice. And so I figured that to make them understand deity worship, they had to understand transcendental name, form, activities. Otherwise, they wouldn't understand. And that all the critiques of deity worship generally tended to come off of this platform. And so I used this, and there's the paper. It was printed in a book called The Gods of Flesh, Gods of Stone. Terrible title. It's not a devotee publication. The Embodiment of Divinity in India. Anyway, I've got an essay in there. This essay about this is in here. And so I make use of it there. To try to just give people an idea of at least what we think we're doing when we're worshiping the deity. And how it is possible that you can have a statue or picture of God that is actually a picture or a statue of God. So I use this paradigm, and I think it was pretty successful. Here are people that had, well, first of all, cerebral kind of people, I mean intellectual sorts of people, who hadn't read any of Prabhupada's books, and were familiar to some extent with the history of religions. And so, using illustrations from Christianity, Greek tradition, Western tradition, I explain these three phases, and then explain where bhakti comes in. And so I used it there. Then they, then the next time I got a chance to talk about this same next opportunity was when I was asked to give this paper about science and religion. Now, I had already realized, you know, that this karma, jnana, bhakti thing applied to different religions. Let me go back to that a little more. Where you see this opposition. I'm talking here, I've talked about it as something an individual person may go through in a person's advancement or progression like this. But you see it historically also, at least this phase shows up historically. Like our account of what happens with the rise of Buddhism. Buddhism is the most thoroughgoing philosophy of negation or negative theology that you see anywhere, especially the Madhyamika Shunyavada Buddhism. And really, you know, that develops, that comes back into Vedic culture through Shankaracharya, who took that, who was influenced by Nagarjuna, the Madhyamika Buddhist, and rewrote the whole thing back into Vedic language and presented it as Advaita Vedanta. But it originally happened as a reaction, Prabhupada tells us, to animal sacrifice, which is an excessive development of a cult of karma. And you get this counterculture, which is, there's not just the Buddhists, but the Jains also, about the same time, of extreme otherworldliness and renunciation. Not coming from the Brahminical class. The Brahminical class, they're chopping off heads of animals like crazy and sacrifices for promotion of the heavenly planets and whatever. But in the case of the Buddhists from the Kshatriya class and the Jains from the Vaishya class. So it was a rejection of the Brahmanas too. So when I looked at this a little bit, this karma kanda or the karma mamamsa, if you look at it, what the karma mamamsa does when it analyzes sacrifice, or when people thought they were doing sacrifice, is virtually controlling the universe. When you create a sacrifice and you follow all the rules and regulations and you do it right, in some case you reenact the creation of the world. And when you reenact the creation of the world, then you can get in there and start to turn things around a little bit by your mantras and by your procedures, your tantras, and so on. It was a culture of technique. And the whole thing was the mastery of technique. It says that in the sacrifice, the names of various devatas are used. Doesn't it depend on the mercy of the devatas that the sacrificial result is there? Kama Mamamsa says no. The sacrifice controls the devatas. They have to do it. This Karma Mamamsa philosophy is spoken, in fact, by Sri Krishna as a joke to his father when he tries him to stop doing the Indra Yajna. He's using that Karma Mamamsa philosophy. Sounds very much like modern science. And I argue in this paper that I gave in Bombay, Science and Religion, using the same kind of paradigm now, that in fact, if you really want to understand karma, kanda section of the Vedas, don't think of it as ritual. Think of it as, you know, laboratory procedure. Think of the priest as much more to be understood as a scientist. Because the whole mentality is the mentality of controlling material nature through the mastery of technique. Precision measuring, precision activity, precision mantras or formulas. It's a scientific mentality. Well, what we would say today was an archaic science, but it was science. Yeah. And apparently that, you know, reached some terrible degree of excess, to which there was set in this incredible cultural reaction in the form of the Buddhist revolt against the priesthood, the scientists. Where people started dropping out and wandering around naked and all kinds of things. Huh? And completely rejecting the world, the Vedas, the whole thing. Huh? So that's a place where you see this transition go. Now what became interesting to me as I thought about it was when I began to realize that this karmakanda started to look more and more like material science, I began to realize that a certain pattern in modern West had also exemplified. Here we're now outside the formal field of religion. But still you have a broad cultural movement in the West. And what you see happening in Europe in the 18th century is what's called the Enlightenment. How do you say? Aufklärung? Huh? Yeah, the Enlightenment. Which was, again, that was the beginning of course, it was based on a rejection of priests and kings and all this other stuff. But the notion was here that Newton, everybody was inspired by Newton's laws, had discovered certain laws of nature. And nature is orderly, precise, regulated, and rational. The only thing irrational is human society. Now let's get together and, using Newton's techniques and Newton's methods, bring all of human society under rational control. Let us extend the methods of science to cover everything. Huh? This is the Enlightenment philosophy. And then I discovered that there was, contemporaneously practically with the Enlightenment, something that is called the Counter-Enlightenment. There's a famous historian, English historian, Isaiah Berlin, who writes about this in his essay. He's quite well known. And people started out as being, you know, members of the Enlightenment. He particularly mentions a German, J.G. Hammann, H-A-M-M-A-N, who started out as a follower of the Enlightenment, but then rejected everything wholeheartedly. And what you get out of this counter-Enlightenment, or counter-Enlightenment, you get people start to emphasize intuition and feeling over abstract thinking. Sympathetic participation is more important than detached observation. And out of this counter-Enlightenment comes the romanticism of the 19th century. And there you get all these things that we associate together: an interest in mysticism, mystical experiences. That's when everybody started to discover the Upanishads and thought there was something to say. It was in the 19th century. Pantheistic philosophies started to flourish everywhere. There was an emphasis, nature is alive. People began to, you know, even in Germany, guys began to dress up as Merovingian kings and worship oak trees and all this kind of stuff. You know, the folk came back as a big thing. Organicism, you know, seeing everything as an organic whole. All these things are all part of the romantic movement, and this mystical sense of oneness was everywhere prevalent. So what I realized is, in its own terms, what you had in Europe, with the Enlightenment, you had a culture of karma, of sorts. Now, it wasn't like the Vedic culture of karma, where activities were regulated, but it was basically, again, a scientific culture of karma. And then the Enlightenment was really an eruption of a culture of jnana. And these two forces have continued. There's been a kind of cultural conflict going on in Europe all through the 20th century between these people that want to push, you know, the Enlightenment view of the thing. You know, let's get everything down into numbers. The whole science deals with things as so far as they can be quantified in terms of numbers, right? If you can't put it in numbers, it doesn't exist. Human beings are just numbers. Everything is numbers. Now let's define the whole world by our formulas, and then we can control it, you know. And then there's the whole counter-enlightenment, that, you know, romanticism, that has a whole different view. That wants to see nature as alive, that feeling is first, that numbers don't matter. So what I realized was that the hippie movement, or the counterculture that swept the world in the 60s, was really, you know, goes back to romanticism and the counter-enlightenment. It's the same thing. You can find hippie documents written in the late 18th, you know, in the late 18th century already. The greens were already there, you know. This is a very old cultural conflict. It's actually what the West is going is the same kind of thing. An attempt to go from a culture of karma to a culture of jnana. Anyway, I argue in this paper they can't do it. They can't even go from here to here. Because when there's jnana, there has to be vairagya. And in the modern West, there's no renunciation. So there's no real jnana, even though people want it. And because even in the phase of karma, there's not even regulated sense gratification. It's unregulated. And that, therefore, there's a cultural impasse that can only be broken in by having bhakti come in from the outside. It's Krishna consciousness. That's my presentation there. So the next time I took this paradigm was used it in the other place was this was a group of scholars from all different they're all academic scholars, but they're all from different religious traditions. There were Buddhists and Muslims and Christians and Jews and Chinese people and all these things, and we come together and. Every person was supposed to give a paper about how his particular group viewed other religions. And so, again, I use this karma, jnana, bhakti typology. First of all, I had to tell about ISKCON a little bit. And so I told about how it started and what Prabhupada was doing. But then I again used this karma jnana bhakti typology to explain that what we are after ourselves is we don't see these divisions between Hinduism, Buddhism, all this other stuff. But what we're interested in this. This is the spiritual development of human beings. And what I wanted to persuade people to do is to start to look at their own tradition, find the element of karma, identify the element of jnana, identify the element of bhakti, and then try to persuade him through this kind of argument that this was the highest. This takes you one step higher. Try to persuade them that what they ought to do is the same thing that Chaitanya did in the Six Goswamis, you know, separate out. You've got these strands woven together. You know, separate out the pure bhakti and develop that. That was my hope with him. So I said that even if there's difficult... See, here's this you know, is within Hinduism an internal criticism. And in fact, when Prabhupada attacked karma and attacked jnana and attacked bhakti, he wasn't so much interested that he had theological enemies he was trying to destroy. What he was interested in doing was purifying his disciples. This comes across, I think, fairly well. If I can find this section here. One devotee says, this is Hayagriva speaking. This is some of his testimony. When Srila Prabhupada first began lecturing in New York in 1966, he would often attack the Mayavadi impersonalists in his talks. And not understanding, I joked with a friend, "Mayavadi? When was the last time you saw a Mayavadi?" None of us could understand who Prabhupada was talking about. We all thought that the Mayavadis were a little group of philosophers in India against whom Srila Prabhupada was waging theologic battle. But actually, we were all Mayavadis. So that's why we engage in this, not to attack others, but to purify ourselves of this karma and jnana, because pure devotional service has to be free from these things. So here's something we do internally, and or best we do within the Vedic culture or within Hindu tradition. So if we do the same thing outside, you know, with Christians and Jews or whatever, you can't say it's our religion attacking their religion. No. But I had to admit in this paper that, you see, there are some traditions that are more hospitable to these kinds of things. Like, for example, in Buddhism, the jnana element is entirely predominant. You see what looks like bhakti come up in various forms of Pure Land Buddhism and worship of the bodhisattvas and stuff like that. But everywhere, people will tell you that all of this is subordinate to nirvana, which is the highest. In Christianity, you have different strands in there. And it's interesting, like Thomas Aquinas, for example, he says that the more abstract words are, the more properly they apply to God. Then after saying that, he ended up denouncing everything he wrote. At the last, he had some vision or something. He said he wouldn't finish the Summa Theologica. So maybe there's other things going on too. Something maybe that he didn't have the conceptual equipment to describe. The problem with Christianity is, while you see from coming from Jesus a very strong element of bhakti, all the intellectual structure, everything they use to think about God in terms of philosophy, comes from Greek philosophers. And Greek philosophy definitely is negative philosophy. The one of Parmenides, the good of Plato, the God who has no companions of Aristotle, the God who is so self-sufficient and so aloof he doesn't even know there's a world. This is the intellectual heritage that Christianity had. The only way they knew how to think theologically was from what was given to them by the Greeks. Because that was the whole intellectual milieu of the time. Was Greek. When the Gospel of St. John starts, you know, "In the beginning was the Word," in arche hino logos. Arche and logos are Greek philosophical terms, because that was just how everybody understood anything philosophical. That was the world in those days. And so because of those, Christianity was always a little constrained in the development of bhakti, because they didn't have some of the tools to think about it. Of course, what really happens, the other part of it, is there's a dividing line here. These people are enjoyers, and these people are renounced. And if there's no Jnana Vairagya, no renunciation, you don't go any further. So if these are really going to develop, there has to be very powerful culture of renunciation.